From Noble Robot on East Hennepin Avenue in purposeful Minneapolis, this is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk games and game development.
I'm Lydia Simchich, and I make nice games.
I'm Steve McGregor, and I make nice games.
And I'm Marth LaCroix, I too make nice games. For this week's episode, our topics are Let's Plays and responsive game design. And so, if everyone is ready, let's start. I think I've got them fooled now. I don't think they can tell that I'm still sick. I think I'm... It's, can't tell the difference
you're
at all.
None the wiser.
Yeah. Doing great.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Well, enough about that. It's Lydia's birthday.
Yeah, I'm older.
That is, in fact, what birthdays do.
Uh-huh. You got yourself some free pistachio slice of cake.
I did.
At our dinner just a moment ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was really sweet of them.
Had a candle nice. And everything.
Yeah. Mark bought my dinner. It was great. It was nice. I did wish on the candle. I'm not telling you what I wish for.
Well, yeah, you can't do that. Especially not on air.
Oh, gosh.
That's doubly bad.
Yeah.
We have a neighborhood pancake dispensary, is what I like to call it, called Relish.
Yeah.
It's a nice restaurant we go to between episodes and pretty frequently here next to Noble Robot. So if you're in Northeast Minneapolis, check out Relish.
Yeah.
So tasty.
And if it's your birthday, you get free cake.
If you're nice and you're, I think is what it was.
I think he said, I look high maintenance and asked if I want cake.
No. It was actually a pretty good joke. He brought the cake but didn't bring you any silverware.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
So he intimated that would be high maintenance.
That's right.
Right. Slandered our lovely waiter just there.
He was great.
Yeah,
10 out of 10.
Oh, it's hilarious.
Okay. Also, serious business.
Yes.
Switch 2.
Yes.
Big announcement. I mean, yes. This is now 2 weeks old for everybody.
Right.
But two big things happened that day. One is the Nintendo unveiled all the Switch details, including the release day, the pre-order day, RIP to that day, and the price. There was lots of big feelings about that.
Yeah.
Particularly the price of games, which is sort of interesting.
Well, specifically what was interesting is they revealed the price, but they did not reveal the price during the Direct.
Yes. And I think it's because they were... One of two reasons. One, they didn't want to draw attention to it.
Yeah.
Which is a little cynical, but maybe that was true. Mm. But also, I kind of think they didn't know. They were
there
was uncertainty. They were narrowing it down toward the very end.
Yeah.
Because if you actually follow, this is we live in interesting times.
Yeah.
The price in various different currencies, it doesn't match the exchange rates. This is macroeconomic talk. I know a little bit about this, but I'm not an expert.
Okay.
But the purchasing power in Japan versus the UK versus America is very much not the same as the exchange rates between their currencies.
Okay.
So it's actually, this is very, we live near the Canadian border.
Right.
And there's a longstanding tradition in both Canada and the northern states of going across the border to buy things depending on the relative buying power of the currency, not necessarily the exchange rate.
It's true.
Mm-hmm. It bounces back and forth pretty frequently. All my life, I've heard stories about this. But that's true pretty broadly all over the world right now. People have talked about how much cheaper it is in Japan, and it's not just because of tariffs or import taxes.
Right.
It's because the buying power of the yen is really low right now.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't just... It's just a consequence of things moving around.
Yeah.
It's just macroeconomics.
Sure.
That said... Also, basically, monkey wrench into the entire world economy, and there's better places to get news about that. But it was just the friggin' worst.
Mm-hmm.
That happened on the day of the Switch 2 announcement, and Nintendo announced, I think, the next day or a day after, that they've canceled the pre-order dates. The release date is still the same, at least from where we're sitting.
Right.
There may have been news that dear listener, that we don't.
Right.
But they're changing the pre-order date because they're assessing. Which might mean that the price might go up.
Yeah.
It might mean that they do an introductory price. It might mean that the most likely scenario is that they just allocate way less units to the United States because they've already said the price. Nothing is permanent. They'd have no idea what's going on. Mm-hmm. So they might just want to, rather than further disrupt things or further react to random events, which is how the world works these days, they will just allocate far fewer units to the US and just come what may.
Hey, Mark here from the future editing this episode, and would you believe it, I do still have a cough, but apart from that, The switch to pre-orders, the revised date was announced. And if you're listening to this on Patreon, it's today. But if you're listening to this on the free feed, it was last week. So hopefully there's still availability. I have no idea because it's yesterday where I'm sitting or 8 days ago, perhaps. Calendar math. Anyway, back to the episode.
So, yeah, it's a rough time to be interested in goods or services.
Yeah.
So, as a consumer or a seller or anything, as a producer. Anyway, all of that aside, because that's a whole other topic that other people have covered grander and better. Mm. What do you think about Switch 2?
Oh my gosh, Kirby, Air Riders. That's all I care about. They showed Mario Kart, and I was like, oh, this looks pretty cool. Mm. They showed that Donkey Kong game, and I was like, oh, this looks pretty cool. But then they showed Kirby Air Riders.
They could have just had Kirby on screen just winking at you.
Yeah, that probably would have did.
Yeah.
That probably would have did.
Also, Kirby the Forgotten Land is getting a new campaign. Mm-hmm. I'm actually kind of excited about that.
I'm excited about that, too. But, you know, Kirby just took everything away.
Yeah. That's a GameCube title, so I don't know the GameCube ever very well.
Ah, yes. I grew up on that game.
Yeah.
It has a very... place near and dear to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just very excited about this new game, and I am shocked that Sakurai was making this and not Smash. Because it definitely seemed like he would be making a new Super Smash Brothers.
From the beginning of that trailer, certainly made it seem like that.
It did seem like that. But I've kind of felt like, not that I think that Sakurai hasn't done a good job with Smashes, but I feel like he's kind of tired of them, and he like puts in a lot of work to get them to happen in ways that I find troubling.
I don't disagree with that, but sure. I think there's a lot of like armchair psychologizing of Sakurai from these fans.
I'm not talking about it from a psychological angle. I know he's got some condition in his fingers that I know he pushes through in order to make the games.
Right.
I mean, it's not like he's not gonna be doing that for Kirby, so who am I to talk? But anyways, I'm very excited for this game.
Yeah.
Outside of that, I don't know, other Switch stuff, I guess.
My friends have been speculating and trying to analyze that one frame of Silksong.
Oh, right, yeah.
Because we have very deep Hollow Knight fans, and at this point, a lot of us were, I was more in tune on that when the Unity shenanigans happened.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Trying to hear anything, and now I think we're at the point where it's boy called Wolf, cried Wolf.
Yeah.
Just going like, yeah, it was a frame, but it looks like a frame that we've seen years ago.
Yeah.
Oh.
And just kind of like, at this point, whatever, it'll happen.
Yeah, it's actually, I forgot about that, but it's actually wild because like people, every single time Nintendo has a direct, mm-hmm. they're like, where's Silksong?
Yep.
And it's wild that they just put like 5 seconds, not even 5 seconds, like 2 seconds of Silksong in there.
Yeah, there's a lot of cynicism breeding now, at least among my friend group with regards to Silksong. And there's still deep love for Hollow Knight and I think a genuine want there to be something. But in terms of like, will it ever happen? The thing I'm excited about is the mouse controls.
Yes.
And they seem pretty, like, especially because lately I've been playing My Sims, the remake of the one for the Wii, which I loved. I've been looking for a used copy for Wii for years now.
Okay.
Didn't we talk about this on the show, actually?
Yes. Yes.
That's how big it looms in your mind.
It did. Well, because in college, there was a very good used game store in the little downtown area. And so we would go and check it out. I got to play Professor Layton for the first time because they had the first three games. I was getting them from the used game store. So every time I saw a Wii section, and there's a lot of used Wii games, I'd look for My Sims. Never found it. So one of the things that's been interesting for me, especially then earlier playing games like Okami for the Switch, seeing how Wii and how the Switch can handle motion controls in comparison to the Wii, and especially because all of my brain is hardwired to use the Wii remotes for that particular game, which I have talked about this before. It's now going to be very interesting to see how the brain will extend to using mouse controls. And I kind of wonder if if it's going to be an interesting mix in terms of how my brain wants to move with those between the Wii remote and the mouse, but also
how
like
how much of your learned experience of like, because there's an abstraction that flows through your body, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
So it might be that there's no learning curve at all. You might find that like it actually just takes longer to get the cursor from one side of the screen to another.
Yeah.
Because the Wiimote, like you could really could zip, you could snap your pointer to wherever on the screen,
yeah,
and then hone in on what you wanted to click on.
Yeah.
Mouses don't really work that. They work a little like that,
yeah,
but not quite the same. So I wonder how much of that people will really notice.
I'm interested in, I love the fact that it seems to be responsive on a lot of different surfaces, because yeah, one of the things I love about the Switch is I could take the Joy-Cons off and put my hands in my pockets and play Slay the Spire while on the treadmill. The rare times I go on the treadmill to just walk. And the idea of like, oh, I'm on a plane and I'm using my pant leg as a mouse pad would be so good.
Now, right. But they didn't show any of that.
Yeah, there's a lot of people assuming, well, it must be that because it's a living room console.
I am doing this based off of Polygon short testing out the responsiveness.
Oh, they tested it.
They did. Yeah,
oh,
yeah, they tried it on.
It
like,
does work, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But like any mouse does work. I don't think they put extra effort into that. I think it'll definitely be a case of like there will be people, and you know, a lot of PC gamers who do play, but Steam Big Picture or whatever, they've invested in little like TV trays or lap desks or things like that.
Yeah.
I think this is just going to be another type of gamer interested in that.
I think what it is not necessarily that the tech is hard. I think the thing is that now it's going to be very interesting to see one console have so many different like input modes.
Yes.
And being able to switch between those, which you already kind of can do with Switch, and it was really fun to play Chicory, A Colorful Tale, because if I didn't want to use the Joy-Cons, I could just draw with my finger. I could finger paint.
Yeah.
The whole
thing.
It was really nice. So now you have that combo. You have the ability to play with the input method that you want to have to some extent. And I'm really excited to see what comes out of that.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond that, I, as someone who didn't have a console until the Wii, and so I never played Mario games, never played Zelda, never played Kirby, and never played, I've never played a Kirby game. Yeah, I never played Pokemon.
You must remedy this.
I played my first real Pokemon game this year, or last year, technically. That wasn't Pokemon Mystery Dungeon DX, which was really fun. But like, I'm catching up on a lot of games that as like are classics and that people kind of expect me to know as someone who plays games and is a game designer. The fact that like, okay, new hardware, but also that usually means that there's going to be new remakes of older games and that they're going to be keeping that kind of archive alive. And so we can talk about that. That is kind of a can of worms, I know, for a lot of reasons. But for me, selfishly, that means, I have the opportunity to play a game that is so deeply beloved and cherished and is the root and history of a lot of others' inspiration without having to get an emulator, figure that out, have to get old hardware, find the game, and risk it not working.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
I could totally see like EA putting the original Sims on this thing. You know what I mean?
It's true.
Like, none of that is announced or anything, but you could totally see if there's enough of an install base, I could see a lot of companies like putting a couple of people on, you know, ports to use mouse input, which would be a lot easier to do in a world where the thing has a mouse.
Yeah, for sure.
I wonder if we're going to see some really interesting, again, it's the flexibility of the input mode that makes me wonder if we're going to start seeing some really interesting stuff in the world of accessibility.
I think what's going to happen is there's not going to be a ton of games that use the unique features. So the fact that both Joy-Cons have mouse sensors, so you have two mice, which is useful for multiplayer games, but also for games that you would want to have two cursors for, which as a game designer, I'm always like, why don't PCs support two mouse cursors?
Yeah.
Or multiple? It seems like a weird, like, I know there's not a ton of like use cases for it, but I could see like 3D applications where you have like two, you know, I could see someone thinking to do that.
Yeah.
But at the hardware level, like Mac OS, Windows, Linux, there's literally no way to do it unless you sort of have to like add on your own sort of stack as a software developer. There's no, and I always find that so strange to me. But the Switch 2 has that.
Yeah.
But so the question then is, are people going to do PC ports like Civ 7 is coming to Switch 2?
Right.
That's wild.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
Yeah.
But then at the same time, are people going to really take advantage of the fact that the accelerometer lets you actually rotate the mouse and a second? Like, are people really going to bother with that when you can't do that on other platforms? Because that's always been Nintendo's thing. Is
right.
Like, it's never been a better system to bring games from other platforms. But are they going to really take advantage of all the things that the Switch 2 has, only to leave them there and almost surely not exist on the next Nintendo platform?
Yeah.
Or at least uncertainly so.
I am so just like, it seems like such a potential for creativity that I just want to know that someone is thinking about it.
Yeah.
And I want to hear what those thoughts are. I'm sure there'll be a couple of cool
examples. Yeah, but it might number in the half dozen.
That I don't care. I want to hear those half dozen. Mm-hmm. I really do.
So what I'm actually really interested in is that, you know, the games I'm working on, I've talked about this before, are PC games with mouse inputs. They have robust gamepad input, but so I've been excited for Switch 2 because particularly Dream Settler is a fake OS game. You could use a mouse. That's its first class input method. But I'm actually really curious if, because I don't think we'll get access to Switch 2 dev hardware in time. And I also not that interested in making a unique Switch 2 version.
Oh, sure.
I'd rather just make a Switch version and then just have it work on Switch 2.
Yeah.
You can plug a mouse, a USB mouse into a Switch. Works fine.
Okay.
Keyboard as well, no problem. Mm-hmm. The question now is because this hardware is unique and there's the both Joy-Cons, what is the default behavior for a game that wants a mouse input? If you turn on the mouse mode of the right Joy-Con, will that work with games that support mice on Switch? Or will it not?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Or will you have to still plug in a USB mouse? I'm very curious about that because it's really going to impact how my games are played.
Right, right.
Now, if I have to engage with the actual APIs for it to do that, then I have to ship a Switch 2 version.
Yeah.
So I'm desperate to learn about the development experience.
Yeah.
Because if it was just the right Joy-Con, then I would have said, like, well, of course, then. It just is a mouse when used as a mouse, and the system supports it, should be fine. But because it's two, and I'm thinking, like, oh, I don't, ooh, they might be separate types of devices as far as the thing is concerned.
Yeah, possibly.
I'm very curious about that.
Mm-hmm. A lot of questions.
Yeah.
Especially the development side, because I haven't heard of anyone getting access to the Switch 2.
Yeah.
Apparently there's been various reports because there's lots of third parties that were announced, a huge amount of them.
Yeah, that's true.
The rumor mill says that a lot of developers have had access to it.
Yeah.
I think it's very selective. Mm. It might be a bigger number than some other consoles early on their cycle, but we're late in the pre-release cycle. It's coming out soon.
Yeah.
Now, for regular Switch 2 or Switch licensees like me, there will be at some point a process where I could apply or even just outright get some dev hardware, but I don't know when that's going to happen.
Yeah.
It might be later this year, it might be next year, there might be an application process. It's kind of the timing was sort of, we made some attempts last year because the two games I'm working on are both going to come out this year.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is like it makes them Switch 2 launch games.
Yeah.
And I was just so like, it's we tried. It's, you know, small potato. We didn't have a lot of hope.
Yeah.
But it's like kind of disappointing that like, and when that happens, we're not going to have time during our launch period to like really make a whole nother version.
Sure.
That really leverages it. We can do some testing if we get our hands on hardware before we launch, but I don't know how likely that is.
Yeah, that's a shame.
Yeah, but I'm anxious.
Like that, yeah.
Yeah. There's a couple things I'm excited about. I love that there's the share mode, which is neat, where you can kind of like DS download play.
Oh, yeah, that's
cool. Share. And it uses the Wii U video streaming tech.
Nice.
Which was really impressive at its time. And everyone forgets how impressive it was to have like low latency local video streaming.
No one remembers that's still the
hard.
Wii U.
That's still hard to do.
Yeah, you know what I mean? That is, yeah.
Like anyone who's ever cast something off their phone, it's actually not that, you know, but to have that be input, the latency actually work for like game inputs and pretty rock solid that the Wii U did a decade ago. It's kind of amazing. And that same tech is being used so that you don't have to download anything for players. You can just cast them essentially. And they get, there's no screen peeking. It's not split screen. They get their own thing.
Yeah.
And so that's why it's only available for Switch 2 games, because they're the only ones who know how to send a different image to the different devices. But you can use a regular Switch as a receiver.
Oh.
Which means that any Switch can play any Switch 2 game with this method.
Nice.
Which means that if you have a Switch, it's a reason to keep it around. It's local two player.
Yeah, like, that's cool.
That's amazing. Mm-hmm. Like, what a cool idea.
Yeah.
I don't know how widely used it will be, but like what a great way to keep the original Switch relevant in your, you know, gaming closet.
Yeah.
Which is really, so I like a lot of the little tiny hardware implement things. And so by that transitive property, the game I'm most excited about is that stupid welcome tour game.
Oh, to get a lot of
show you all the mini games and how to use the thing. I love me a tech demo.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even care that they're going to make me buy it for $5.
Okay.
And I think the reason they're doing that is because Nintendo be Nintendo. But also, like, everyone knows how a Switch works. Like, I don't think it would have been interesting if there was a pack-in game. And people are really like, they are like morally incensed. They're like, are they charging for this instruction manual? It's like, don't buy it. You're fine. You know how to use the Switch. You're fine. Don't worry about it. I'm going to spend the $5.
Nice.
And I'm going to enjoy every second of it.
It was made for you.
I love it. I love me a tech demo. Yeah. So I'm thrilled about that. Mm-mm. And then the other one, I mean, the more I hear about Mario Kart, the more I'm interested in it.
Yeah.
It's pretty exciting.
It does look genuinely really cool.
Yeah, an innovation on the formula, which is like, I guess if it was any, I'd buy any new Mario Kart, I guess. Mm. But I probably wouldn't get it on day one unless, yeah. But I'm actually interested in this particular version.
Yeah.
Which I couldn't have said about the last couple of Mario Karts. Mm. Like I bought Mario Kart 8 just because everyone else was buying it.
Yeah.
And it's fun.
Yeah.
But it didn't seem that unique or interesting. And I enjoyed it, but, you know, so it goes.
Yeah.
But this new one, I'm actually kind of interested to get it day one. Mm. Donkey Kong, it's not a Mario.
Oh, that does look good.
But
though.
It does look kind of cool.
Yeah.
3D platformer.
I did remember there is one game that I am genuinely interested in, which is Enter the Gungeon 2.
Yeah.
And actually more so now that I think about it, because I really enjoyed Enter the Gungeon, but I haven't played it all that much because I'm not that great with controllers.
Mm. Oh, okay.
Like it because I'm so used to playing on PC controllers and playing anything that requires actual reflexes using a controller has been harder for me.
Sure.
The first time that I felt very successful with it was when I played Skyrim for the first time.
Yeah.
And I started actually like being okay at Skyrim.
Yeah.
So I need to go back to it. And that it does occur to me though, if that ends up not being something that I'm good at still with a game like Enter the Gungeon, maybe a Switch 2 where I could have it be a mouse control is the thing that would let me play more Enter the Gungeon.
Interesting.
Because I really like that game. I'm just not good at it. and it's not necessarily in a like Binding of Isaac, because I love roguelikes. They're my comfort genre. I play them before bed. And it, in the sense of like, oh, I'm not good at this and I can get better. But in like a, my hands just don't necessarily know how to do the thing my brain wants to do.
Yeah.
That's more frustrating. And that's harder to get over. I wonder if that having that mouse option for me would be cool, because then I also could switch in between, like maybe, I don't know, maybe one of the maybe having a controller for the boss is going to be easier, but having to deal with a big room with lots of enemies, that is more comfort with mouse.
That is one of the things that the previews that I read remarked upon, which is that the games that do support mouse are also lets you switch back and forth at will.
Yeah.
Which is cool. That I think that might be the actual innovation of the mouse mode, is like you're able to have games that can have different sections of the game better suited to one controller.
Like, oh man, imagine the WarioWare.
You could, like, all of those horror games that have puzzle elements along with shooting now could actually feel good in both version, like in both modes.
Like, you could design multi-modability into your design because you could be assured. Like, when I'm designing PC controls, I'm thinking of, like, what happens if someone is using just a mouse
and
not a keyboard?
Yeah.
Okay? I have to account for that. And it might not be, they might not be able to do all the things I want to do as well, but I have to accommodate them, or I have to let them know they won't be accommodated.
Yeah.
Right? Both are fine options. But, and I'm like, well, I can assume a lot of PC players will have a gamepad.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't true 15 years ago. It was far less common, but it's extremely common now for people with PC who are just PC gamers to have a gamepad, but it is not guaranteed.
Yeah.
And you shouldn't expect that.
Mm-hmm.
And so you should make your mouse and keyboard modes like suitable and as first class as a gamepad, even if you're making a platformer, even though I can't imagine why you'd want mouse and keyboard on a platformer. Those people exist.
Mm-hmm.
And you're selling a game to them, so you kind of owe them at least some accommodation.
Yeah.
But with this, you know, because it's a console, you know what they have, and it's multimodal.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. In a way that the previous Switch, even with its touchscreen, wasn't.
Right,
fully multimodal in a real way you could leverage with your design.
Y'all are selling it. The mouse stuff more than Nintendo did, frankly.
I'm excited to see what happens. I think the consensus, we just kind of talking with my husband, because we at this point just joint own all of our consoles and go in together, which has been true for a long time, is that we're not going to go right away to getting a Switch 2.
Mm-hmm.
But it is not as it is more possible in the future than I think we originally thought that we were going to go get a Switch 2 at some point.
It's likely you'll have it by holiday.
I don't know by holiday, but at some point we will.
Mm-hmm.
We will get it. And I'm excited to just see how people use it and play with it. I'm excited to be surprised by it, I think, is really what it is.
Mm, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Yeah. And I mean, this is like the longest console generation of my lifetime. And so like there's just something fun about it, you know?
Yeah.
Like this program launched when the Switch came out.
Right, it did. I can always forget.
That's how long ago it was.
Yeah.
That's the other thing that's wild to me. I don't think of the Switch as being old. Like, quote unquote old.
Yeah.
I forget that it's not the newest hardware. I keep even just replacing the Joy-Cons once, you know, having to do that kind of upkeep. I still think of the Switch as a new console for some reason.
Oh yeah. I mean, Well, I think a lot of the pandemic has really warped our sense of epoch.
Yeah.
Right.
And so that's some of it, I think. But also just the, you know, things got good enough to hold on to for a long time.
Yeah.
People are much more invested in their game libraries than they used to be. And so there's just less appetite for more frequent 3 or 4 year updates.
True.
And so there's many reasons why the console generations are lasting longer now. But for Nintendo especially,
yeah,
this is a very long time. And I think a lot of that had to do with how short the Wii U's lifespan was because of a failure in the marketplace. And so that added on to the Switch came out earlier than it might have expected to, but it was also such a huge hit and lasted for so long and was good enough to, you know, to deliver new games 8 years later,
mm-hmm,
that still felt fast and robust.
Yeah.
And Nintendo's classic, you're not going to compete with the Xbox port. It's going to be a different game.
Yeah.
Or it's going to be the Xbox port, but it's going to be an indie game that's using a tenth of the power of the Xbox,
right,
so it's easily comparable.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All of these factors have combined.
Yeah.
There's so much more headroom for most games. And then you have the big games that need all the horsepower, and those will just be on PlayStation, and they're fine.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so all those reasons, I think, just the generation's way longer. But, like, it's so strange, because when you're my age, and I'm thinking, like, the difference between, like, the Genesis and the Saturn.
Yeah.
Or the Super Nintendo and the N64. The Super Nintendo and the N64 was, like, 4 years.
Yeah, whoa, right, yeah.
And that is a school generation.
Yeah, and when I was that age, it felt like a really long time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it feels like exactly the same amount of time as this, like, generations have gotten longer as I've gotten older, and like the time dilation has matched up perfectly.
Oh,
so it all feels, all the generations feel the same to me.
Oh, that's wild. Okay.
Yeah.
I think
it's
different for different people.
Yeah.
But probably people around my age or within 5 or 6 years of my age, up or down, probably feel that same way.
Yeah.
Where it's like the Switch doesn't feel that much longer than the difference between, you know, the Xbox and the Xbox 360 or the, you know, the PlayStation 2. But
sure.
Like, it is longer.
It is.
Yeah.
Very strange. Mm-hmm. But I mean, so summary. Uncertain days ahead in terms of being able to buy the thing.
Truly.
But, like, we're excited for different reasons,
mm-hmm,
at different levels.
Yeah.
And it's probably going to be around for a long time, so I guess there isn't kind of no rush to buy it.
That's true.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
Last piece of meta news. We've gone really long on the meta, but last piece, we've been, Steven and I talked about games that we're working on that are asking for money right now. We released a bunch of stuff to our Patreon backers.
Cool.
We released minigame Plox, which I think I talked about when we talked about this previously.
Mm-hmm.
People really liked that. We're getting some bug reports and feature requests, which is pretty cool.
Aww.
I set up a little Discord forum for our users.
Cool.
Which is nice. We're sort of collecting feedback already. It feels very much like a launch.
Oh, yeah.
And then 2 weeks later, we put up the Page Genie, which is my page building toolkit.
Yeah.
And like, I also published the spec for the language.
Oh, okay.
For the markup language. And listeners who don't know what I'm talking about, go back and I talk about it in more detail in a previous episode. We'll link that in the show notes.
Mm-hmm.
But people are, this is the first time I have released something in a long time of any kind to an audience.
Yeah.
And it didn't quite, I knew that was true, but I didn't quite realize it until I was hearing people using it and giving feedback and like saying what they like about it and like engaging with the ideas in it.
Yeah.
And it's not a game release. It's something totally different.
Yeah.
But I'm getting all those same emotions.
Okay.
As if I release the thing.
Yeah.
But it's to a narrow audience of, you know, it's a good number of people.
Uh-huh.
You know, many hundreds of people, but like, who are, you know, part of the Patreon. But it's been a very unusual experience and I did not expect that at right now. I'm like busy with a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And I didn't also want to be like engage, like actually in a launch period of a thing.
Yeah.
So it's been very stressful, but it's also been very satisfying and very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And people are making things with the page builder and engaging and writing things in the markup language that I wrote and catching all the different efficiencies that I put in and seeing all the jokes and understanding how the language is both the real world language that the cage content is written in, but also the in-universe language that the characters of the game use. And they're understanding that connection.
Cool.
In a way that's really satisfying.
Yeah.
So it's been kind of a thrill.
That's awesome.
And also like a weird, it's it pulled, like I was expecting to do all of this later.
Yeah.
So it's been kind of strange,
mm-hmm,
but I mention it here because I will put in, some of this stuff, like the VS Code plugin that I made for it, the actual language spec and the reference documentation.
Okay.
If that's the kind of nerd you are, and I suspect many of you are,
mm-hmm,
those are all, published free and open source. And so the WYSIWYG page builder, that's part of our, you know, the actual game.
Yeah.
But I decided to make it like an open source language. So it's available. So I'll put all those links in the show notes, and you can check it out for yourself and see what, you know, part of what I've been up to. For a long time. It's been sitting around for a couple of years and just getting slowly polished up to now. But yeah, it's been a weird couple of weeks for me.
For sure.
Since we spoke last on the show about
it. But that's really cool. Yeah. You got a thing out. I know that's something you wanted to have some stuff out for a little while.
I've been anxious to publish, just get something out.
Yeah.
It's been just to tick a box almost has been kind of, it's not more deep than that, but it's been a while since I've released anything, and it's getting really antsy. So this counts, I guess.
Yeah.
Is it a kind of a second wind morale boost to get through a bunch of the stuff because of, that's a very, very validating and tangible experience, confirmation that you're doing something cool in a way that doesn't have the underlying responsibility that you had talked about in the begging for money episode, where it's like, and we're responsible for making a thing that's cool because all of these people are throwing money at us and believe in the project. And we don't want to disappoint, and with the underlying subjects being, and we don't want to disappoint them or betray that trust.
Right. So what's interesting about that is it feels much more like they bought the thing already.
Yeah.
And now they're just in the support forums, and I don't treat them like customers. I treat them as users.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's, so that, that, the distinction is almost in just in your head, really.
Yeah.
Because it does sort of, in the way I talked about it before, all that is still true.
Okay.
But it is interesting. It does feel different. Like it's a dip. And the stress now is basically just like when people, like there's been some bug reports, and a lot of them are just people not understanding how it works or things that I know are not finished. And we said there were, you know, be bugs or not finished features.
Sure.
And so getting through all of that and actually looking at like, oh, okay, this is actually a proper bug I should look into and make sure I get my notes on it. Don't forget when I get robust to it and work on it more robustly. But like, it has been kind of satisfying to get it out there. But it is like it's all almost canceling each other it out because it's a weird, I didn't want to be doing this now.
You're right.
I wanted to be doing this later.
Yeah.
And so it's this kind of like interesting, like influx of interesting, positive, like mostly really positive feedback.
Okay.
It's been very gratifying, but I don't feel like I'm ready for that right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I have to make sure to like stop and absorb it and like appreciate it because I'm not like in the mode to be doing it.
Yeah.
And so that's been a little stressful.
Sure.
Actually. But on balance, very good. Yeah.
So, first topic, kind of near and dear to my heart is actually Let's Plays.
Yeah.
Not sure if I mentioned this to you too, but we've talked about this before, right when you asked me to join the podcast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I had mentioned it as a possible topic that I found interesting. And part of it is I am kind of nostalgic, or they're kind of important to me as a person who exists in the world of games, because up until the point when Let's Plays became popular when I was in high school, I didn't know that I played video games.
Yeah.
Oh.
Because
you thought you could play computer games.
I played computer games because I played games that you had on a CD-ROM and you loaded up into your computer. I didn't have a console. I didn't have a handheld. I didn't, as we mentioned, I didn't play any of those classic games that you played as one did, like Final Fantasy or Kingdom of Hearts or anything like that.
Sure.
Hadn't at all. And yet I was playing all the, I thought they were actually fundamentally different things.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until Let's Play started coming out and I started watching them that I realized, oh my God, Markiplier is playing on a PC.
Yeah.
Like he's playing all of these. And then I started hearing game titles that I recognized as quote unquote video games, like Resident Evil or Silent Hill, that were played on PC by these people that I'm watching. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I play video games. That's wild. And that kind of started my own, was part of the genesis of my own journey into understanding video games and expanding my knowledge and starting to play. And I also had a romantic partner who lent me her PSV, or what is it, PSP Go, so I could play Persona 3 for the first time, my favorite game.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, that sort of journey, which now I'm here. I'm a game dev. Whoa.
Yeah.
But I also really value them as a toolkit in my own dev toolkit and just like building a repository of information and examples for things. There is the joke that, you're a game dev and you don't have time to play games.
Yeah.
Right. But then there's also the risk of, you should not trust a person who says that they're a writer, but says they hate reading.
Right.
Because a lot of the kind of compostable idea material that sits in your brain and becomes new ideas comes from your lived experience, but also the media you see.
Yeah.
And also there's a lot of things that you can benefit from having touchstones, especially now that we're in however many decades of video games existing. There are a lot of problems and design decisions that people have also had to encounter and make decisions. And it's really helpful to see how they do it.
Yeah.
And also it's fun.
Yeah.
I recommend people, if that is a something where they go, man, I want to play more games, I can't play more games, or it's just not in, it doesn't fit in, like, hey, try Let's Play, see if you find someone who you vibe with or who plays games that you vibe with.
Yeah.
And watch those as a way to experience games and to expand your knowledge of different genres and different public titles. Mm. Another thing, I love horror games. I think that they're absolutely beautiful pieces of art. I love seeing what they do. I think they're so creative and so interesting. My fear response is to freeze or to fawn, which is not the type of fear response you want to have if you want to play a game.
Right.
Because that essentially means you don't do anything, and that's not playing a game. And so I thought I was just weak, like a wimp. Mm-hmm. It's because like I want to engage with it and I physically feel like I cannot. Mm-hmm. And so I get to experience and see a lot of horror games, which I wouldn't necessarily play or be able to play, but would want to by watching Let's Plays.
Yeah.
In addition, there are games where I just don't want to play them. Like I've because I had PC games and I played by myself. I'm not a multiplayer person, really. Yeah. I like couch co-op and I like playing a single player game with two people. Like mm-hmm. co-op Baba Is You is great. Love it. And so party games, multiplayer games, those sorts of things, I just would never buy them. I wouldn't play them, but I like watching other people play it. And it is like the way that I know that they exist and the way I get to see what they do.
Okay.
That is what I personally get from Let's Plays. But I also know that the main argument and a very valid concern is, well, you're not actually experiencing the medium if you're not playing it.
Right. I think you're sort of illustrating pretty clearly like what you get out of it that is also specifically not playing it.
Yes.
Right. You're not mistaking a Let's Play for the experience of playing it.
Yeah.
And I think like knowing that, I think, is really important.
Yeah.
Because then but understanding what you're missing and what you're not is, I think, a harder thing to do. I think in the case of like horror games, you were just full know that like you're not getting the experience of playing it, but that's fine because you don't think you could get that in the way that it's essentially intended to.
Yeah.
And so you just fully understand the difference.
I'm also noticing more things that other people aren't noticing because I'm watching it. I'm in the moment and I don't have that funnel vision.
Yeah, yeah.
Which sure. I love because for me, it's a lot of that, like the design decisions, the production decisions, how it is constructed is fundamentally what I love.
Right, right.
I think there's a phrase used in D&D and other tabletop to describe the difference between wisdom and intelligence. Intelligence is knowing that a tomato is a fruit and wisdom is knowing not to put it in a fruit salad.
Right.
I feel like that kind of applies when deciding, okay, am I going to watch a Let's Play and or am I going to get the thing I want from it by playing it or by watching it?
Yeah.
So if, for example, there is a really cool horror game called, what is it called? Oh, Endoparasitic. It's called Endoparasitic.
Okay.
You play as a guy who only has one arm. All of his other limbs got ripped off. And so you are using only the mouse and you can only do things one at a time with your hand.
Mm-hmm.
You're even moving around. You're locomoting by dragging yourself around. And so it is a fascinating game decision. It is really cool, just great game in general. The sensation of only using one arm to control the game by only using the mouse is something that I know by not having my hand on the mouse, trying to load my gun, grab my gun, put my gun away so I can move around. That's something I'm not going to get because I'm not playing it.
Right. Yeah.
Now, if that game was on Switch 2, just saying.
I mean, there.
It's still a horror game. So I would just be like dragging my little torso into under a table and going like, I gotta go past, but I don't know how. Help. That is the sort of thing that I can look at and watch and I can recognize and have learned to recognize. I'm not going to get the full experience of playing this game.
You can appreciate the design decision. You can understand its implication. You could see its effect on the player you're watching.
Yeah, but there's an embodied knowledge that I will not have.
Yeah. And it's sort of up to you to decide, like, do you know enough either to provide a full sympathetic profile in your head to imagine, and does that give you enough confidence to say either have an opinion or take that in as knowledge,
mm-hmm.
you know, or do you feel insecure about that, not having that full experience and so say like, well, okay, I'm not gonna file that as confident knowledge. I'm just gonna have a thing I sort of know about.
Yeah.
And then if I need to draw on that, I know that it's not gonna be something I can lean on too hard.
Yeah. It's very much like having a library of examples of things.
Yeah.
Like a library of examples of different ways that journal entries have been shown in UI, for instance. There are a lot of games that have that mechanic, and it's helpful to see how people represent it. Or, you know, you also get to notice examples like, how do you make a player know that you can climb on things? One of the things I love about Horizon Zero Dawn is any cliff ledges that you can climb on are covered in bird poop. Like, one, visually, high contrast, white bird poop on the stone.
Well, I don't know that it's meant to always be bird poop, but
it's not always, but very frequently.
But it's white. White is the signifier.
Yeah. Yes, but it looks like, but also like any form, if you're from a city and you have pigeons, you know anything that is vaguely a ledge, even if it's a small one, is going to have a bird on it.
It gives it kind of like a narrative framework for you to just kind of like, ignore any discontinuity.
Yeah.
Even if it's not literally meant to be bird poop, it's the kind of thing you would see in a tableau.
Yeah.
In a space like that, so it doesn't read weird.
But it's a very that sort of thing. Even if you don't directly steal it, but that sort of thing is very handy to have because you are inevitably going to have the decision of if you're level designing of how do I tell people where to go and what is climbable? How do I tell them what they can engage with.
Right. And you know this is like a big point of like occasional gamer contention.
Oh, yes.
Right.
I do. But that's why I love the bird poop example because it's not someone running around with yellow paint. But it is birds running around with their own special paint.
Right. Well, I mean, I think in that case, it's like it just depends on when you want to communicate. If you're trying to make a game, it's like a rock climbing simulator, then you don't want to have the yellow lines
or
the bird poop because you want the player to figure that out.
Right.
But if you're doing a 3D action game and someone has to climb a bit, like, mark it. Who cares? Like, you're not designing a game that where people need to puzzle out the real world. I think gamers are very much too, they're tricked by how realistic games look.
Yeah.
That they forget that games are not real, are not simulators.
Yeah.
Nor are they in any way realistic.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't have to bend down to pick up anything. You just press a button.
For sure.
And very often your character doesn't even animate. The thing on the floor disappears.
Yeah.
And yet, no, that doesn't bother anybody. Like, it's just because we understand the language of these things, but then suddenly something that they think should look one way looks something else, and it feels like they're being babied. And I think, I don't have a lot of patience for that because it's the wrong question.
Also, frankly, they are getting baby. Deal with it.
Because user testing has proven that they need that help.
Yeah.
But I think the thing is once you have a large enough library, then you can start going, okay, well, what were the problems that they were solving and why are they different than this other example that I have?
Right.
And that sort of knowledge base is not the type of thing that I would be able to glean from like a picture.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also not the type of knowledge base that I might even realize playing the game in the moment because instead I would be like, I have to climb this thing because something's going to eat me.
Yeah.
Or I have to climb this thing because there's the coming of age trial that's happening right now and I need to win.
Yeah. Well, it's why there aren't markers anywhere in the Zelda open world game.
Yeah.
Because when you have those instincts and you need to know where to go, the puzzle in a lot of those third-person games, the puzzle is not to like say, is this climbable or not?
Yeah.
Because what it is that a limited amount of things are climbable.
Mm-hmm.
Knowing which is and isn't is not a mechanic in the game.
Right.
Yeah.
So there's no reason to make that hard on people. Just tell them what it is.
Yeah.
Whereas in Zelda, in the recent Zelda games, you can climb anything, but some things climb better than others.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you learn that. So it is a mechanic, and that's why there are no markers.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Because it actually is part of the mechanic, and those are definitely, it's not just a choice of like putting the white or yellow paint on there or not.
Yeah.
Right? And these are kinds of things that you can, like from a Let's Play, you can get kind of a sense of how players react to that, how instinctually they are.
Right.
You don't necessarily have to experience that yourself. You can sometimes see the player intuit something without speaking to it out loud or making any mention of it. You're like, oh, they just knew because that those clues were there.
Yeah.
You can read a lot from player experience just by watching.
100%.
Yeah.
Well, because you're essentially watching playtests constantly. Right. And that's the other great thing. Kind of.
I disagree with that.
Okay.
Okay.
I wouldn't say that a Let's Play is a playtest. Because when you're asking people to playtest, they are expecting to give feedback.
True.
So their way that the way that they play the game is different than it would be if they were to just play the game, understanding that the game is done.
Yeah.
They will probably go on Reddit or whatever and complain about a thing they had an issue with. But that's different from like a playtest experience.
That is true. Yeah. I do like the fact, though, that by virtue of it being a performance, that they have to fill the air.
That's true.
Which is nice.
So they'll talk about what they're having an issue with.
Because the thing is that they will be in the moment trying to figure something out. They have also part of their brain saying you need to say something, either because it's live or because it's going to be edited and you can't just have the dead air because something's happening. And then that sort of, and also, I mean, it is ramped up of depending on the Let's Player, for example.
Yeah.
But a lot of it can be that often is that very genuine reaction because it is strong enough that then they amplify it.
Yeah.
And so that's also kind of cool because then you can say, you can also kind of check yourself as a dev going, oh, that looks obvious, but I'm a bystander. The person who's in the chair is not understanding it. That's another instance where it's like, oh, I wonder if I would have that same trouble in the chair if I was playing.
That's a thing that people in chat don't fully understand.
No, they do not. Yeah. And that is something where there are certain things where I get frustrated, but I also recognize it is because I'm seeing it from the outside and not actively trying to figure it out.
Yeah, I think that I feel like the Let's Player who is putting on a performance, I think that does taint the experience, or it taints the product ultimately as a something that a dev can learn from.
Mm.
Because there are, I think if you watch a Let's Play of Myst, for example,
sure,
you're going to have players doing a lot of things to eliminate dead air.
Yeah.
But you actually, as the designer of a game like that, you want them to lean back in their chair for 5 minutes and think about a thing.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I think that this is one of the things that bothers me about Let's Plays. Steven opened the door on disagreeing with you. So
I was waiting for you to step through the door because I knew you were going to.
Well, you weren't saying anything really wrong exactly.
Wow.
But we're getting there now.
Okay.
Which is, I think that Let's Plays really, I think they influence the way that game designers think a little bit too much.
Okay.
Because it represents, especially for an independent game developer.
Sure.
The library of Let's Plays that exists on YouTube and Twitch represent 98.5% of all the gameplay of somebody else they've ever seen in their life.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? Like, count all the times you play games with friends or watch them do something. And then for someone who's really engaged in watching this content, they're going to watch so much of it that, like, that's what playing video games looks like to them.
Yeah.
And I think, and as a designer, you're trying to think about, like, what will appeal to players, what will be satisfying to solve, what's an interesting challenge, what's enough friction.
Yeah.
The model player you're thinking of is this person on stage performing. And I think I think it really poisons, or potentially poisons, and this depends on how far you lean into this as a designer.
Yeah.
You may not know you're doing it, and it also may not fully influence you because you also play video games. You know how things work,
right?
Mm-hmm. But I think it does influence people. Like, this is how video games work, and definitely, I mean, one of the things publishers say all the time when you're meeting with them is like, how would this look on a stream?
Yeah.
Because it's very promotional.
Yeah.
And not only, you know, and you need to make a game that doesn't have dead air, that will engage a streamer, that will also not engage them too much, because then that's going to mean that they're going to be too focused and not attending to their audience.
Mm-hmm.
So it needs to be. So like all of these things about a Let's Play experience are very different from a play test or just a player experience or a QA experience or you as a developer playing your own game.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and I think if you take too many cues from that as like this is how a playthrough works, so you see a lot. There's a huge category of videos on YouTube that's just no commentary walkthroughs.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
And those are more like traditional playtests, but you actually don't know what that person is doing, like or what is influencing them, so you don't hear from them.
My bias is that they already know exactly how to go through the game, and that essentially they're a visual instruction manual.
Yeah.
Right. They don't want to goof around because it'll make them look like a bad gamer.
Yeah.
So you'll see that. And so that also is not as helpful as you think it might be.
Right.
But in ways you don't understand,
if
you don't understand what's unhelpful about it, you can just kind of, hopefully you can trust that it's not a fully authentic experience.
Mm-hmm.
So that worries me greatly.
Okay.
Influence on designers, on how things play. And then on top of that, the notion of I think this is why I wasn't arguing with you before, because like you understand there's just a difference. It's not the same as playing a game.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of people who will watch a game and they'll be like, I've got my fill of it. It's a very narrative heavy game. The gameplay might be interesting, but like what I would buy this game for is the story. But I'm getting the story. so I don't need to buy this game.
Right.
I think that happens a lot.
Yeah.
I think that there was, you know, Let's Plays when it became, now it's like fully accepted. There's no arguing it now, right?
Yeah.
Like, I will tell people, if you're someone who is interested in this, like, it is a fact that a Let's Play is a copyright violation. It absolutely is.
Okay.
But developers and publishers have no interest in levying or asserting their rights because it's also a marketing opportunity. Mm-hmm. But that has fooled people into thinking that it's fair use.
Okay.
It's absolutely not. It's people allow it because they prefer to allow it. It's not that they're powerless to stop it. They are now because it has a cultural force. But the reason developers don't stop Let's Plays is because it is good for them in a lot of ways.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
What that means is that there are types of games that can't be made because
that suffer from you.
Or can't be made as readily.
Yeah.
Because Let's Plays exist to spoil games or to not just story but mechanic, and then you have to count on an audience to either avoid the spoilers, and what that essentially is putting a movie on YouTube. Mm-hmm. Like, it is amazing how many people don't understand that a story is, in just because it's in a video game, it's still a story.
Yeah.
Like, you're not allowed to, you can, you know, fair use is about modification, commentary. It is not about presenting the art to someone.
Sure.
And I think when people say, well, it's different because someone's playing it and every playthrough is unique. It's like, sort of, but like, mm-hmm. they're all protected, mm-hmm. right? Just because it's different from somebody else's doesn't mean it's a different movie.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Someone takes a camcorder into a movie theater and you know, records the whole thing. You got some people coughing in the corner, the thing's off kilter, the colors are all wrong.
Yeah.
You put that on the internet, that is a transformative work.
Uh-huh.
In fact, it's a greater transformative work than a Let's Play is. Mm. Like, by an order of magnitude, it's more transformative. Mm-hmm. Because there's a greater context, there's a different, it's worse, right? But it is by all legal definitions, it's transformative. No one would argue that's not copyright infringement.
Yeah.
But I think so that's kind of beside the point. But I think part of that is how we understand how people engage with Let's Plays as content and how we think, like, well, it's not the same as playing a game, but that doesn't mean it's not robbing you of the experience of playing the game.
Sure.
A part of the experience of playing a game.
Yeah.
Right? And then, but also in a very real sense, it's a very positive marketing tool for games of all types, including narrative games, mm-hmm. even those ones that'll be spoiled and they'll lose sales from that, but then that will be offset
yeah.
by the amount of people who are so interested they want to play it for themselves.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, like, is it a net negative? I mean, I can't argue necessarily that it is, but like, it does change how games are made and how they work, because, you know, reviews don't move games anymore. A lot of it is creator content,
yeah,
and a lot of that is driven by playthroughs and Let's Plays and sponsored Let's Plays,
yeah,
where you can set down some ground rules on what to show and what not to show,
yeah.
But you want people to play your game so other people can get influence on it. And as an artist, it's very frustrating,
sure,
right? Because you actually just want to sell the game in any way, and hopefully, if you have a publisher, that's their problem. And then you want people just to experience your thing.
Yeah.
And so when you know it's going to be Let's Played and you know that's part of your marketing strategy, like, well, okay, well, I can't put too strong a hint of the twist in the opening chapter, because even though I want the player to have a good guess as what the hint is, because that's the story I'm writing. I want them to feel that they know the twist coming for so long.
Yeah.
That's an important part of my design.
Yeah.
But I can't do that, because then you'll have all these people who don't own the game who know the twist, even though they only watched the first 5 minutes of my sponsored Let's Play.
Uh-huh.
You know? And like, these are real things that change the art you are allowed to make.
Yeah.
Or that you can have an effective, you know,
yeah.
influence on the audience.
So I definitely see where you're coming from. I definitely agree that Let's Plays have changed how people approach making games in a way that I think is frustrating. I specifically think of it in terms of like getting money to make a game. All of the heckin' pitches that we had for Future Club, and they're like, yeah, but can we make this a little bit snappier or whatever, so that like it looks better, yeah, stream friendly and all that.
Yeah, stuff. Let's Plays is almost an outdated term now.
Yeah,
right.
Because I think
it's the same thing, though.
Yeah,
I mean, it's live streaming is a very different dynamic than edited Let's Play.
Oh yeah, yeah,
in large part because you have the presence of the audience, and that depends on the streamer and how quickly they look at chat or how much they engage.
Back and forth, yeah.
But also, I mean, because I remember one of the Let's Players that I watched a lot when I was in high school was the Rad Brad, and what was abnormal about him and really admirable, he only played and then posted once a day. Meaning, if he was struggling with something or had a question about something yesterday, the next episode, he actually was like, I read your comments and now I know what's going on.
Okay.
He didn't batch as far, like, he didn't batch upload, and then you had him doing the same three episodes doing the same frustrating thing he didn't get, and then he finally got to read the comments. Yeah. That is very different, and the stream, and how a streamer will engage with the audience and how the audience in that way bleeds into the stream as well is very different from edited content.
Yeah.
What I was going to say is that while I agree that like it has fundamentally changed a lot of things about how people approach games, I think that part of it is pushing back against, I think, is the idea that like players don't understand that they're robbing themselves of a game by just watching it online.
Yeah.
I think it depends on the game. Like, I feel like people will probably watch a visual novel or something and be like, oh, I'm probably just getting the exact same experience. Like, I'm talking about this from a player perspective because I don't have high opinions on players, I guess. But I think that players might do that for a visual novel. But I think players understand that if they're watching somebody play this game, they're not getting that experience. And they are effectively spoiling the actual gameplay experience that they would get otherwise if they were to play it themselves.
I mean, there is that idea of who's responsible for a spoiler.
Yeah.
Is it the person who is knowingly going into the experience and has the point where they're like, oh, this seems like something that I will want to play and I will be actively spoiled on, which I have personally had that experience with Let's Plays. I started watching like the first couple episodes of Game Grumps play Danganronpa, and then just the art and the whole thing, it's so amazingly mishmashed and campy, and it's a mystery.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty quickly going to be a mystery with some visual novel elements. I'm like, this is so my alley. I can't watch anymore.
Yeah.
And I then also realized, having to watch two people figure out a mystery when I'm five steps ahead of mystery is going to be deeply frustrating. I'm very glad that I didn't finish their series, and I instead just, like, a year and a half later, played Danganronpa myself.
Okay, so I think this is something that is taking this in a different way that you two are taking it.
Okay.
Which is, you're talking about, when it comes to spoilers, you're putting the viewer in the pilot seat there. The viewer decides, and they have the self-restraint. I'm not going to spoil myself on this thing because I one day might want to buy it.
It's not necessary. I'm not saying they have self-restraint. I'm saying
they do. I would take that as read, that some
one
people do.
I'm saying, like, is the responsibility for one's own boundaries in terms of spoilers upon the viewer of the Let's Play, or is it upon the artist making the story that one could have Let's Played, or is it upon the person creating the Let's Play with the knowledge that some people might be that there could be spoilers ahoy?
Well, this is the point I'm making, which is that if I'm making a story and I sell it,
yep.
Mm-hmm.
It is not your decision whether to spoil yourself on it or not. You don't you buy it or you don't.
Uh-huh.
Like you don't. It's if it's available for you to watch for free, then you have the control of, am I going to spoil myself or not?
Okay.
Like, if I'm telling a story, I would want you to know about the thing.
Yeah.
Because I want you to buy it.
Right.
That's marketing.
Yeah.
But I think people, because streams and Let's Plays are so synonymous with video game marketing right now, that we forget that, like, marketing is not the same as giving people part of the experience, right? Like, if I want to do everything I can to convince you to buy a copy, but I don't want you to decide whether to watch it or not, without paying for it.
Okay.
Like, you know what I mean? Like, if you're like, well, you know what? I'm probably not going to buy this game, so I guess I'll just watch the thing and spoil myself. I would rather you not see it ever. You know what I mean? As an artist. Like, now, as someone marketing a thing, I would want you to see enough or be convinced enough to buy it.
Yeah.
But that's, so apart from that, and that now in this day, what that means is watching some of it.
Sure. Right? Yeah.
But I think that, like, you don't have the right to decide to see it without paying for it. You just don't have that right.
Okay.
Like, you gotta buy it. Like, I think that we've just completely changed our notion of, like, I think people do have that ability to say, like, well, oh, this is really interesting to me. I think I'm sold on it. Mm-hmm. I'm going to turn off this Let's Play because I want to buy it.
Yeah.
Like, that's great. That's a successful piece of marketing.
Sure.
That's fantastic. But like that person should not have that choice.
Well, okay. So for instance, if I was living in an apartment with a bunch of people,
yeah,
and they were playing a game that I was interested in playing,
yeah.
That's a different right. What you're talking
about. And there's actually a legal distinction here, which is okay. Like which is a public display or broadcast.
Sure.
So the difference between like loaning your friend a copy of Jurassic Park,
yeah,
and putting it on a projector in the park,
yeah,
without a license to distribute,
right?
That's a different thing.
Yes.
Even though mechanically it might be very similar.
Yes.
Right. Moving your television up to your window so everybody on the street can watch your HBO.
Yeah.
Like that is not legal. Like,
right.
But having 30 people over to watch Game of Thrones is legal.
Yeah.
Right? Like, it's, and, you know, it might seem like a technical distinction or what's really the difference, but, like, there's a real difference.
Well, what I'm saying is the way that, at least from the way that I'm interpreting how you're describing it, is a lot of it feels like a legal difference, a legal distinction that is harming games in a way that, I think that, like, if you were to play a Mario game and I were to watch you play that Mario game, even though I might be interested in playing that Mario game, and then I decided, oh, I don't want to watch any more of this Mario game because I want to get it myself and play it. I'm still deciding not to get spoiled on the rest of the game.
Sure, right? Sure. I think spoilers is kind of a proxy for what I'm talking about.
Sure.
All of this stuff.
But right? The way that you're framing it, I'm thinking of it, I'm interpreting it in terms of like a legal thing, which is a. I think, you know, as relevant to this topic, perhaps this topic is too large for...
Well, if you have a private Let's Play where you just have two people over to watch you play a game, which is not an uncommon thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Right? That has the same effect.
Yes.
Right? But it really is a difference of scale and relationship and...
Yeah.
The fact, and when you stream it to maybe 12 people, if you're an average streamer, you know, with a tiny audience.
Yeah.
Or potentially millions upon millions of people.
Yeah.
But that you're not... And you're promoting your stream as your product. Mm. And it is... It's not just a legal distinction.
Sure, sure.
It is a proper distinction.
The way you were describing it now, I guess, was like a legal distinction. You're right in that like watching other people play the game is different from playing the game.
And I think people do. The reason that I mentioned a legal distinction is because people will often say, well, how is this different from? And then on a sort of technical sense rather than like a... The thing about the law that I think people don't quite understand is it's like, it isn't actually a game of technicalities.
Mm.
It's a game of like realities.
Mm.
Like... You know, it's like, okay, technically, if I give this video cassette to a friend of mine to watch over the weekend, how is that technically different from giving it to a stranger who then gives it to a stranger who gives it to a stranger who mails it to me at the end of the month?
Yeah.
Like, how is that technically any different?
Yeah.
Maybe it's not, but it is different.
Okay.
Right? Yeah. And that's that's the thing about law that people don't understand. It's not just a matter, because it's not video games.
Yeah.
Right? but I'm getting a little bit on the weeds on that stuff.
Sure.
But what I mean is that experience is something that is taken so far out of the hands of the developer.
Okay.
And how they want people to experience their work.
Sure.
And I'm thinking of this because like the projects I'm working on are very narrative heavy.
Yeah.
And one of them is an FMV game.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's a lot of video content.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You could conceivably feel like you got the experience from watching it.
Yeah.
Now, I would like to think that there's more to it, but at the same time, we're not designing it to be much more than that.
Yeah. Okay.
The core of the experience is watching this content.
Yeah.
And so... You could easily put that on YouTube, and you would have a really hard time taking that down without massive backlash.
Yeah.
And so that puts you in a really rough situation, not because you designed it to be a richer experience that people aren't really getting, because as the designer, we're designing it to be a slightly richer experience.
Sure.
I shouldn't have to be forced to design something much richer than a linear experience.
Yeah.
You could design a game that just you press A every 2 minutes and experience a thing, and that could be your game.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, that's allowed. You don't have to make it more interactive or more interesting mechanically.
Yeah.
It could be a very like simple, dumb game that a Let's Play would 100% replicate. And so that's the scenario I'm describing is then if that is the case, hypothetically, then what makes a Let's Play okay, I guess? Like why is that all right for people to be able to have access to?
Good question.
Yeah. But it all, I mean, I think ultimately it's a question about the culture of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how do we encourage people, do we encourage developers to, like we said, we want developers to play games. Is watching a lot of Let's Plays a good proxy against that? And is it worth is it good as a piece of library? And from an industry perspective,
yeah.
Like, you can, you know, if you're a screenwriter, you can go to the UCLA library and read all the scripts, even though those are not publicly published.
Yeah.
Because it's an internal industry thing. There's a value to that. You know, you can see, you can go, if you're in the theater, mm-hmm. you can go to a library and watch videoed recordings of every Broadway play, even though none of them are available publicly.
Yeah.
And you could do that for free if you're in that industry and, you know, meet certain criteria.
Mm-hmm.
Let's plays for developers may serve a similar purpose, but that's not their place in the world.
I find them very helpful in terms of like making the decision to play a game for the experience as a designer. I find it very helpful to have as a narrowing experience.
Yeah.
Because in the same way that if I wanted to research something, I go to Wikipedia first. I read the kind of essentially the overview, and then I go, okay, these are the keywords that I need to look up in order to find the thing that I need. Because oftentimes I don't know where to start.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, you know, for example, again, I don't play party games. I don't play multiplayer games, but I know of a bunch. And so because I'm designing a ideally someday multiplayer party board game, Mario Party is definitely up there. Pummel Party is up there. Mm. So, but getting to play Pummel Party with my team as a bunch of developers during a game day was really good because, and this was somewhat, I mean, it's somewhat surprising, but also I think mostly just because I don't play these types of games, but it was really good to have this experience. The types of decision making and risk management and risk weighing that you have in a party game when you're against other people cannot be replicated in retrospect or from a distance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because so much of our decision making and our risk perception and our weighing of the odds is emotional because humans are just not good at that.
Right.
That's something that you can observe and you can see, but in terms of actually experiencing it yourself is not something you can construct. I like having that because I can get, I can manage and have a broad swath of what has been done and how do people solve some of the problems and hit some of the same notes. So that way then, if I need to play a game or I want to play a game in order to really understand how it works from the player perspective or to see if I'm missing something, I know which game I need to get. Yeah. I know which game I need to play, or I know which game I need to play with other people or on my own or to see it up close and experiment myself.
Yeah.
And that's not something that you can't really faff around with that. You don't have a lot of time. It's not the type of games are not usually well, like, yeah, a flashy reel is going to get someone emotionally excited, but it's not necessarily going to get me to understand what the game is going to be like.
Well, you're also not the audience for a trailer, right? Because you're not actually looking to see if you want to buy this game. You want to learn something from it. So a let's play is much more valuable to you in that library sense.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes it's a little bit both. See Danganronpa. Oh, I love that series. It's so good. It's so good. Love it.
Yeah.
But there's so much now. Mm-hmm. It's not as, and the world of video games is so big, and I want it to stay big. I want there to be more options and more variety and more indie and more AAA and everything in between.
Yeah.
And I want to be able to see what all is out there.
Yeah.
Being able to sit down and do that, make that time to do that, especially when as a developer, I'm on the computer all day.
I
don't want to be at the computer all day. I want to be able to knit or do a hobby or take care of something else or be able to enjoy something with my husband. Being able to sit down and look at this and get something and learn something and talk about something is very valuable to me in a way that is significantly distinct from working as a game dev.
Yeah,
sure.
But I get to still engage with that part of my brain in a very creative way that I don't normally get to, depending on the project I'm working on.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah. And I think that value is, I think you can't. There's, it's inarguable. You like that. That's especially the efficiency of it.
Yeah.
Right? And the fact that you really couldn't get it any other way.
Yeah.
Because it's just not the time or the structure for it.
Sometimes it's the only resource that's available.
Yeah.
Like for example, when you're trying to cluster different types of tiles on a board game.
Yeah.
How do it, and it's not, and having them evenly distributed is not hitting.
Yeah.
How do you find how to solve that problem? There aren't there are some wikis that have like the board layout for video game boards.
Yeah.
Not a ton.
Yeah.
It is oftentimes the only way that I can actually see how Mario Party distributes their tiles, which by the way is not evenly distributed. They're usually clumped of like three together or close enough together. So that way, every so often, you are guaranteed to hit that tile. That's the sort of thing that is a core design question I have to decide so I can tell my developers how to implement it.
Yeah,
right.
That just doesn't exist. That resource doesn't exist. That image doesn't exist, or it's extremely bad quality. I can't tell what's going on. And that's not the type of thing that I can easily find answered by someone else. At that point, I do have feel that I have to like do what the painters did, go and look at the master and try to and copy it a little bit and see why it works.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that is true. I will leave you with the analogy you just had at the end, like look at the master and see how it works. What that actually is buying and playing the game.
Yeah.
But like I said, there it's an invaluable resource to be able to do that more efficiently.
Mm-hmm.
And also, and well, like you said at the very beginning, knowing the difference.
Yes.
Like understanding what you're getting from it. I think that the just in terms of the artist rights component of it is you're not paying for the artist for that. And what you might be doing is paying the streamer for that
mm-hmm.
in some cases. So like, I think that that's a thing that I think we just kind of forget sometimes is like, mm-hmm. is who is providing that value and that entertainment. And for you, it's serving as like as a library component. Like there's a strong argument for that to be available to you for free and available to the industry for free, but you're engaging with through a method, which is a form of entertainment that is public, that is different. So I guess all sort of fine lines, I guess, of it. But like the literacy that can be spread through that, I think, is probably underappreciated by game developers, I would guess. But the topic, I think, remains kind of hairy, I think, because of we're not really the audience for those things.
Yes.
At least in that context.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Sure. I mean, I guess the way that I consume Let's Plays is basically I think of it as though my brother was playing a game and I was just watching him play through it.
Right.
Very similar
like,
for me.
Yeah.
He stopped playing God of War Ragnarok, but I was just watching him play it. and I was like, well, this seems like a game that exists. It's a thing I can have while I'm playing Spirit Island on my laptop.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I don't know. I do forget the legal murkiness of it. And that's why I kept bringing it up because like that is a very strong.
When you play Spirit Island on Tabletop Simulator.
Shit.
You didn't pay for that, right?
Yeah.
That's I mean, okay. I don't know. I also... Part of the why I really value having the library is so I can, and maybe this is just me trying to feel better, but I know I now know a game that I can then recommend to other people.
Yeah.
There are so many games that I have seen and some I have played and some I haven't, but that like I know I can say, oh, this seems like the type of thing that you would enjoy.
Yeah.
And I hope that in that way also I can keep paying it forward because otherwise I would just end up stuck in my own little bubble.
Sure.
And I wouldn't end up knowing about any other games and that's, you know, not everybody has my taste, but I do try to pay it forward in that regards as well.
Yeah, I guess that's kind of what I was going to say is that like the legal ramifications of what you're talking about are compelling reasons to not have Let's Plays for me.
Yeah.
But the actual artistic stuff behind it, I can't control how players play my game regardless of if Let's Plays exist.
Yeah.
Like if they're playing a game and there's a screaming baby behind them and I made it and I'm like, tell your baby to be quiet. Like, I'm not going to do that.
Yeah.
There's so many things that it will influence a gameplay, someone's gameplay that I can't control.
Yeah.
Including if there's an audience or if they want a bunch of other people to see it or whatever or what have
you. Well, I guess the point I'll make is that you actually do have legal rights to control some of those things.
Sure. Right.
You cannot legally shut that baby up.
Yeah.
But you do have the legal right to say, you take that off of YouTube. I didn't choose you to play it.
Right. That's
I have a sponsor deal and I'm going to have someone else play it so they can sell it. You know, but like you would be pilloried for exercising those rights.
Sure.
It's just way too late for that.
Yeah.
Like no one, like I fully recognize that there's like no way that will ever happen.
Yeah.
People are just allowed to play video games on YouTube forever.
Mm.
And like only Nintendo ever makes a fuss about it. And they don't even do it that much anymore. And everybody hates them for it. And like, that's the world we live in.
Yeah.
And part of the reason we account for it, not only just the steamroller, but like
it,
like people do then recommend it. It becomes a vector for word of mouth.
Yeah.
And whether that's on balance, fair or not, is actually different from game to game.
Yeah.
You know?
That's true.
There are definitely plenty of indie games that like, you know, they just are content for somebody's stream and they don't get any sales off of that. And all they are is just provided that streamer with an hour of content.
Yeah.
And like, did that really hurt anybody? Maybe not. It probably didn't convince any of those people to buy or never buy that game.
Uh-huh.
They may never have heard about it. So really, what's the harm? Well, the harm is that you did labor for them. It is all, sometimes it can be very esoteric or almost theoretical in a sense.
Yeah.
But I think that we just we just don't think about that enough. If we want to come to terms with the reality of what it is, that we are discounting artists' rights in favor of these other things, then okay, but let's know that.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
I think there's also, I mean, this is every person who considers themselves a creator or an artist will feel differently about that. Mm-hmm. There is very much, that is a very person-to-person thing too.
Yeah, it's totally different.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'd like to think that a lot of the games that I would make, I would be perfectly, well, I say this now.
Yeah.
I would like to be perfectly comfortable with the idea of a bunch of people watching a game that I made get played.
Yeah. The music industry is very aggressive about protecting rights.
True.
And if you stream, if you have a stream and you put music in the background, YouTube has all these auto filters, and then some of your ad revenue goes to those artists.
Yeah.
Why don't games work that way? What would be wrong with that? The music industry says when you play a U2 song in your video, some of your ad money just goes to U2.
Yeah.
It doesn't get taken down.
Oh, I see.
Right? And so, like, why don't games do that?
That would probably be better.
Right? It would change the economic model. It would make it less profitable for streamers to stream games all the time.
Uh-huh.
But, like, maybe it should be less profitable for them to stream games all the time.
I mean, and, well, the alternative right now is games just, or videos just get taken down in a way that, like, I know everybody finds frustrating. So, like, I don't know. That seems like a better alternative than the way that it works now.
But people would, I mean, I think everyone would revolt against that. It seems reasonable, but I think people would hate that.
Streamers would hate it.
Streamers would hate it. Their audience would hate it.
Would the audience hate it? They'd still get the content.
Yeah, but they're the ones who fund the streamer, and then the streamer has less money, and, like, people have a parasocial relationship with those streamers. They care more about them than they do about the games that they play. Like, I mean, I would love for it to happen, but I'm a little pessimistic that people would understand that that's fair. They would think that's not fair, I think. Is my guess.
Give us money, please. That's my pitch.
I think I need to believe it a little bit more.
Please.
We already had the begging for money episode.
Right.
Which you could have listened to 1 week in advance if you gave us money on Patreon.
Oh, Lydia, beautiful. excellent. Yes. If you go to patreon.com/nicegamesclub.
If you want to hear Steven grovel more. If you want to hear Mark get on his knees and beg.
Yes. Patreon.com/nicegamesclub. Donate any amount and you get all our content.
Yeah.
1 week early, in fact, if you want to listen to our
episode. And ad free.
Potentially with photos of my cats. I gave you photos ages ago. I don't know if you've posted them yet.
Well, we'll see. We got Ellen's dogs up there. We'll see if we get your cats up there as well. There's some bonus content related to some of our special episodes.
Yes.
We have extra interview content on the Patreon as well.
Yes.
Our old GDC episodes.
Right.
Lots of bonus stuff. But the main thing you get is all of our episodes 1 week early and ad free, which is a nice little bonus. But of course, the real main thing you get is the satisfaction in supporting
the show. Yeah.
Some folks that, you know, bring you some interesting content.
Right.
Every week.
Patreon.com/nicegamesclub. Please.
I believe you.
Good.
Live on DAZN Worldwide.
Saudi Arabia.
Saturday, May 3rd, 7 p.m. Eastern. Canelo versus Skull. The King stakes his legacy once more for the undisputed crown. Standing in his way is Warrior Skull, undefeated and poised to decimate the division on a knockout weekend of boxing.
Let's make history.
Get Canelo versus Skull, Saturday, May 3rd, 7 p.m. Eastern, live exclusively on DAZN. Buy now at DAZN.com.
I'm talking about responsive game design.
Yeah.
And I originally titled this section as game agency, so all of my notes reference that. but that's fine.
You had some difficulty titling this one.
Yeah. Well. Okay. So what I wanted to distinguish it from the idea of, like, developer agency, which I think could be a cool topic, but its own topic, where, like, the developer is the developer has agency within the game to provide the experience to the player. And it's different from player agency because, you know, the player, or what the player can do in the game, effectively. The way that I wanted to frame this, and I think, Lydia, when I described it to you, you hit it on the head that, like, we're really talking about, like, how the game is responding to what you do as what the player is doing and how the player is experiencing this thing. So an example of what I'm talking about here is Resident Evil famously has adaptive difficulty, where if you're doing poorly in the game will go easy on you and reduce the amount of enemies on the screen. If you're doing very well in the game will get more difficult for you because it thinks that you need more of a challenge. And so it will adjust as things change. And so you'll eventually hit, you know, a nice point where like you feel challenged enough that the game still feels interesting as you're playing through it. There are other examples of these kinds of things in games, but I guess I wanted to talk about it because like I think that like it's an interesting avenue, and I was thinking of it in terms of like the game itself having agency, which is why I titled it the way that I did.
Well, I think what's interesting about the Resident Evil example that you gave is that it hits on something that's a little bit more nuanced than what I end up thinking a lot about in terms of the potential for adaptive challenge or adaptive difficulty or responsiveness in a game in learning and development. Because when we think about that, we are thinking about keeping you in the zone of proximal, like in ideal learning, where essentially it's not so challenging that you shut down and you can't think, but it's not so easy that you just, you blitz through it and you just don't think.
Yeah.
What's interesting about with Resident Evil is that, yes, it's challenging, but the thing is that when it comes to that level of challenge, what I feel is more interesting with that is you want them to stay in a certain margin of fear and uncomfortableness, which is off in this case they're equating to the level of constant danger, and I guess, and in that term, because you are anticipating danger because you're seeing in front of you, then the fear of more danger, that suspense.
Yeah.
And I think that's the difference. And that's why this is really interesting and somehow and slightly different than just it's harder if you are better.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The goal is to craft an experience so that the player is engaged in the way that the developer wants you to be engaged, though, most of the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
In a way that like difficulty levels would not allow for, because like, you know, a hard difficulty might be too challenging for maybe the majority of players. And it's up to the player to decide whether or not this game is too challenging for them. And you oftentimes have to pick that before you even know what the game is, which isn't necessarily a reasonable request for the player in that moment. They just don't have that info.
What's the baseline difficulty of the game or whatever, right? And I think players kind of understand, or they expect a normal difficulty to be like something most people, you know what I mean? There's kind of a broad understanding. I don't think people have a lot of choice paralysis there.
No, I'm not talking about it in terms of choice paralysis.
Yeah.
I'm talking about it in terms of like the player can't make this decision themselves because they don't know what difficulty level they're signing up for.
They have
They don't know what they'll like.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I'm excited to see more nuanced versions of this, but I've really enjoyed when they have difficulty levels that are contextualized in terms of what experience you want to get out of it, especially when it comes to like RPGs where it's, you know, you want to pay more attention to the narrative and so combat is not really something you want, or do you want it to be very tactical?
Yeah.
You know, it still doesn't feel as satisfying to me as someone trying to decide between some options, but that is getting better.
Mm-hmm.
One of the other things it makes me think of, and I'm wondering if this is in the vein of what you're saying, but I've heard that in one of the Silent Hills, depending on if you look at certain things for a long time in your inventory, you click on them or you inspect them in your inventory, that changes the ending you get.
Oh, I don't know.
I think I've heard that, but in general, what that's kind of an attempt of maybe wrong example of is the idea of the game clocking what you find interesting.
Sure.
And what catches your attention.
Yeah.
Almost.
Yeah. That's interesting.
That to me is kind of a non-combat way that could go. And you can track that sort of thing. We do that all the time. You can track what you're looking at in the game.
Yeah.
That's a pretty easy thing you can implement, and you can get a lot of interesting data from that. We do that in implemented that for therapy games, for instance. And you can do that, and you do that in terms of how like monsters and things or people will respond to you, your character. That would be very interesting if you could infer and glean something and then make changes based on that action.
Right.
As simple as what do you look at? Where do you stand?
Yeah, you can potentially like change the amount of content that a player is experiencing if they appear to have less interest.
Yeah.
On certain things versus another thing. Or and increase the amount if they're ignoring content that you want them to see for some reason.
Yeah. Be kind of fun, like what if you're playing Skyrim and you only liked to engage with shopkeeps? Like would that have changed how Skyrim like, or like only went to certain towns, you know, that sort of thing.
I'm curious how seamless you'd want this to be for the player, because I think in your Skyrim example is interesting. I think people who like to play games in an alternate way like that it's an alternate way.
True.
Oh,
and I think a game that catered too much to them might start, like, they might start feeling, and this is going to be different for different players.
Yeah.
Some people might be delighted, but they're feeling that the game is deeper and richer for the choices they're making. And some people are like, oh, but I'm trying to find all the corners, or oh, I'm trying to do something weird or different.
Yeah.
Mm. Like, I'm, you know, and so I wonder how seamless you'd want to make it. And I think your example for difficulty is that it's an open question for that.
Yeah.
But for everything, like anything that is responsive in that way. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I guess I kind of see. Well, I think there's a danger of like trying to predict the player too much.
Yeah.
And it can feel like you're railroading them into a specific experience.
Yeah.
In a way that like just would probably lead to a bad experience. I think if a player feels like they're not being able to, that it. Effectively, it would be removing a lot of the player's agency in a way that might be bad for the game. Mm-hmm. I tend to be an advocate for removing as much player agency as you want, because I don't know, the player gets enough agency as it is. But
they can decide when to jump. That's enough.
Yeah. But I think that, like, you know, it is important for the player to feel like they have a say, because it is a conversation between player and dev.
Yeah.
It's important for the player to be able to feel like they have a say in the game's experience to some extent.
Right.
And so if you control that too much, then the player might not as well not be there, and the game could just play itself. So I
almost, the thing that I think about the most with this, or is one of the biggest narrative advices that I hear for DMs and people who play tabletop RPGs is the fact that NPCs have lives. And they don't just go into T-pose stasis mode when your players are not there. Like, villages, if you go back, they have changed.
Yeah.
Like, and there are games that have that as well, are very compelling. Mm-hmm. And so I almost wonder if that's kind of, that feels like the level. If you overuse a pile of hay in Assassin's Creed, does it eventually flatten and is not able to be jumped into?
Yeah.
Or does it get cleaned up?
It is kind of amazing how permanent those piles of hay are.
Right? Like, that is the designated pile of hay.
Yeah.
It will forever be there. It's like that hair elastic that is on that part of the floor and you never pick up.
Yeah. I'm reminded of how the Dishonored games, if you go around killing all the enemies and stuff, the world becomes darker and grimmer.
Yeah.
Due to your effects. And I think, admittedly, I kind of think that it's, well, a little heavy handed, but also like this one person is not have so much influence on the world that they can make everything feel darker.
It's
like,
metaphorical.
Yeah, yeah.
Your
exactly.
psyche is darker. That's all.
Oh. It's also, it's sort of a richer version of the classic, you know, good path, bad path.
True.
Paragon and Renegade, right?
Yeah. But that feels like I can't remember if it like actually affects how you have to go through certain levels in the later games, and I didn't play them, so.
Well,
I,
the thing is that changes your experience of being in there.
Yeah.
It changes how you perceive yourself in the world, which is the precursor to how you engage with the world.
Yeah.
Are you in a position of power? Are you in a position of agency? Is there a threat?
Yeah.
Or do you have some form of power or advantage because that accumulates? It's that like cumulative opportunity almost. That I think, even if it's not actually a tangible buff or nerf, that is a very powerful thing, because if we see the change, we infer purpose and infer meaning in it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. I suppose that the change needs to be communicated in a way that makes it clear that the player has made a difference.
Oh, it has to be like one to like thing happens, effect happens, probably.
Yeah. Well, potentially.
So not at all seamless.
Yeah, I guess like it's kind of interesting because the example I keep bringing up, Resident Evil. The way that works is if you die, like things, you know, you'll get spawn less enemies, or something, and you'll be able to see that if you're like paying attention to the amount of enemies that are on screen.
You have a breather.
Yeah. But. It's not like expressed that you've died such and such amount of times, and so now we're going to spawn less enemies. It just
players happens. Do hate when there's like the extra. Do you want an extra heart?
Yeah,
like you're dying a lot here. Like Mario does that.
Oh my gosh, I hate that so much. Right. I'm like, yeah, I'm bad at this game. Let me be bad at it. Dang it.
Temporary invincibility, totally okay.
Yeah, it's true, right?
That is essentially a very subtle, very slightly longer temp invincibility. Not because you are more powerful, but because the area is slightly safer.
Yeah, I wonder if that's partly just due to tradition. Like, you didn't used to be able to get extra lives because you died a lot. But you always had invulnerability.
I think it's because things change, like, run through to run through.
Sure.
Whereas, like the things that change within a run through, mm-hmm. I think are probably more easily tolerated by a player.
Okay.
Or rather, they feel less judged. On their performance than they would on, like, next time around, everyone's got half hit points and there's way more health laying around. You're like, well, I want to get better. I don't want to be, you know, I don't want to skip this level.
Right.
But then some players were like, oh, great. This is exactly what I needed. Otherwise I would have skipped this level. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of hard to predict.
I think it's also because of the overarching tone of the game. If it was Doom, and you had a lull in enemies, that would go against the core feeling of that you want to have for Doom, which is constant action, constant slaughter. You will rip and tear your way.
Yeah.
With Resident Evil, and especially when it comes to when you want to have a particular extended emotion, you have to build that back up.
Right.
Especially considering you're going to die. Mm. You're going to maybe be frightened, probably be potentially be frustrated, and then have to go, all right, where was I? What was I doing? Mm. And there that you have to essentially bring yourself back into the suspension of disbelief and bring yourself back into the fiction.
Yeah.
So that because otherwise you'll have a disconnect. And then it's just like, well, I got to shoot the thing. And then that's not, I mean, you got to shoot the thing in Resident Evil, but that's not, it's not the same tone.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good point. I think that, like, there's a way to do it right in a way to do it, like, subtly so that the player doesn't. I guess what I'm saying is, like, I don't necessarily think that the player needs to be aware of the changes all the time. But if that's important to the experience, for example, in Dishonored, it's important that the player realizes that the decisions they made are causing all of these rats and stuff to spawn or whatever it is.
Yeah.
But it's not as important in Resident Evil. Resident Evil just wants you to get at the tension level that they want, that it wants.
I think
it doesn't want you to think about the levers it's pulling.
Exactly.
Yeah. It'd be really interesting to have something like this for a like otome game, like a romance genre game.
Mm.
Because the thing is a lot of times relationship sims, romance sims are so transactional. They're you give person this, you do something with this, they equal heart, they love you.
Yeah.
That bothers me so.
You've leveled up.
Me too.
Yeah, one of my first mentors in game dev specifically made a game. It's called We Should Talk.
Okay.
Looking at, can you have that kind of mechanic without it being transactional? And I think that that would actually be really interesting and also very a lot more akin to relationships, platonic or otherwise, in real life, where like there is this building of a mood or this building of a this is the right time to do XYZ, have this conversation, have this moment, and people pick up on that and vibe off of that and. That can end up going into certain places. I think that sort of adaptiveness would be really interesting for that kind of relationship sim.
Yeah, I think that's great. I think that's a good avenue for that. That I think because I agree with Mark. I feel like a lot of times and you too, Lydia.
Yeah,
a lot of the transactional romance stuff that happens where you give somebody a gift and they love you forever. That's creepy.
Yeah,
and it's also like the Astarion approves, Lazel disapproves.
Yeah, that stuff too.
Like you don't. You should not fundamentally agree with your partner on everything.
And you
should
shouldn't
agree on the important things.
Yeah, and you shouldn't be making decisions based off what you think your partner
I think the will challenge be. On that is so deep. It's because there's some things that are not games.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know
what I mean? Yeah.
That's like true.
Now, which isn't to say that there's a way to do something there that's interesting.
Yeah.
But I think once you decide it's a game, you've kind of already lost.
It would be so interesting, though, to have, like, because especially with romance sims, you know, they have to have drama and plot.
Yeah.
It would be so interesting to have a moment, like, there are moments when romance is not happening and it shouldn't, but so often that's when, like, player is stepping back for them to see how plot unfolds.
Yeah.
I think it would be really interesting to have a game where something the love interest is actively struggling with something. Now is not the time for you to want to kiss them.
Yeah.
Now is the time for you to listen and engage with what they're dealing with.
Yeah.
And having that you go the traditional route of like, here's some chocolates and please tell me and please I love you would make them feel worse towards you.
Right. Sure.
Because that is not the time for it.
Yeah.
That would be an interesting, and I think that that takes all the formulae of a traditional romance plot and adjust makes it just adaptive enough that then the mechanics are, you know, there is a time and a place for the mechanic. There's a time to press A, there's a time to press B, kind of that. Yeah. A lot more complex than a traditional like visual novel.
And to tie it into the topic, like if you were playing a Dragon Age game and like, I can't remember any of the characters' names. I can't remember any of the characters' names. I didn't play the game. I just watched someone play it. If you
was it legal?
No. but if you were, you know, playing this game and like this character's performance in this fight was poor and they felt bad about it and you went over there and you started trying to give them gifts, maybe to make them feel better or maybe because you wanted to romance them, that would make them feel worse because they feel like they didn't deserve it or something. It could match with their that could be part of the game in a way. That could potentially be interesting, at least more interesting than the way it works now.
Yeah, or even if it still both gave you a buff, maybe in that moment, talking to them gives you more of a buff, like gives your romance or your relationship a higher mark than giving them a gift.
Yeah.
You know, or maybe they're not, maybe for different characters it's different. Maybe if someone doesn't, is kind of quiet, they understand and appreciate the gift more in a moment when they're struggling. You know, I think like there's a lot more nuance you can have just by having that extra dimension.
Right. And that makes the relationship feel at least a little bit more on balance. Like that gives the character more agency in a way that the game can allow for.
Yeah.
In a way that I find very frustrating about a lot of these romance things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you have to kind of read the player intent a little bit more too. Like the game needs to know why you're doing a thing.
Yeah.
That's the hard part.
Which is difficult because you're asking the player to just answer more questions, which they don't have a lot of patience for.
Right.
Well, and so games tend to kind of assume, this happens a lot of time in dialogue trees where you pick a thing and it's like, that's not what I meant.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, and so you kind of have to, games like that are successful when the player is not the character.
Yeah.
When the when the player takes on a role as a storyteller and guides the actions of a character who is not them. But that's hard for the player to wrap their mind around sometimes.
Yeah,
and a lot of games don't bother with
that. That's kind of why I like the variable being action or purposeful action or purposeful inaction, not what do you do in the moment.
Right.
Especially because, I mean, that's the thing that we have for any form of data analysis from games. We can collect a lot of data. Does it mean anything? Who knows?
Yeah.
Because that was one of a lot of the things we have with educational and therapy games is we can get a lot of data, but they want very specifically to know what's happening.
Yeah.
Because there are markers they want to know that they're hitting. But if someone is looking at something and that is considered a data point marker, it could just be they took off the VR headset and your headset happened to be looking in that direction.
Right.
And then it's the bird is pretty. We made a very pretty bird. It's not because of insert therapy thing here that the bird is meant to be doing in terms of, you know, whatever. Right.
That's a huge problem just broadly in qualitative science, which is what do these numbers actually mean?
Right.
And you kind of have to decide what they mean, but then you have to be open to it not meaning that sometimes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And that's very, very difficult to then calibrate the trust in your own data.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And ultimately, if you want to, you have to be able to decide what player actions are in terms of computer data terms and then make an inference on what that means and then make an inference of how you should respond to that.
It's that huge problem, and you're just like, it's a smaller version of the problem, but it's the same problem for a game that wants to have the kind of responsiveness.
Right.
I like that the examples that we're pulling though, because they are they're so small.
Yeah,
that's what's beautiful, is that they're so small that they have to work most of the time, or at least you can think them so through that you can get them to, you can design them so that they would work most of the time.
Right. And you can allow yourself to be somewhat ignorant of the player intent and then just hopefully communicate what the game thinks their intent is. And then that can be enough, perhaps.
And it's not permanent. Because you could die, maybe because you had put down the game for a couple months and you were rusty. But then if you are really good at Resident Evil, then...
It starts ramping up again.
Exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's you're not damning the player one way or the other.
Yeah, just because you gave this NPC a gift right now doesn't mean they won't like the gift later.
Yeah, it's just now's not the time.
Yeah, now
their mom died.
Right,
exactly. I think there's a lot of potential here that I want to think about more.
I would be really interested to know if there are other examples in games with that sort of thing. Or if there are other moments where a player would feel seen in some way by the game reacting to them.
Yeah. Let us know, listener, in our Discord. If there's something that really felt like the game was responding to what you were doing in it, Like Lydia said, I'd be totally happy to hear that.
Mm-hmm.
How long have we been talking?
Forever.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's our show. For show notes and links on today's topics, go to our website, nicegames.club. Hey, Nice Games Club is on Patreon. Support the show and get stuff. You heard about it earlier. I'm going to tell you again. You get ad-free episodes delivered to you 1 week early if you're a patron. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. And if you want to keep things more casual, just stop by nicegames.club/discord and say hello. So until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice. Show notes.
Well, you can look it up. We're like paused right now.
Okay, thanks.
I can do some coughing.
Live on DAZN Worldwide.
Saudi Arabia.
Saturday, May 3rd, 7 p.m. Eastern. Canelo versus Skull. The king stakes his legacy once more for the undisputed crown. Standing in his way is Warrior Skull, undefeated and poised to decimate the division on a knockout weekend of boxing.
Let's make history.
Get Canelo versus Skull, Saturday, May 3rd, 7 p.m. Eastern. Live exclusively on DAZN. Buy now at DAZN.com.
What's standing between you and your first sale on Shopify? Time, expertise, resources? What if you could multiply all three? Product descriptions? Done. Store insights? Delivered. 2 a.m. customer questions? Handled instantly. Entrepreneurs on Shopify are reaching their first sale faster with AI that works with you. Go to shopify.com/firstsale to see how entrepreneurs use AI to grow their businesses faster. That's shopify.com/firstsale.